Okay, well, let's start by sharing with you my feeling that, as skeptical as I was in the beginning, and interestingly, I don't think it's a new phenomenon. I think it's just been called other things at other times. At the time of Freud, there was an illness called neurasthenia. Have any of you ever heard of that? And when you look back at the time of Charcot and the time of Esdale and the early hypnotherapists, there's a rich literature that sounds very much like chronic fatigue syndrome. But it was called neurasthenia in that time. And I'm sure if you went back and looked at Greek times and Roman times and other times, you could probably find a syndrome that fairly well fits this one, but with just different names associated with it. What I'm really saying, in a sense, is that this is nothing really new. It's just that we're looking at it a little different kind of way now. The term that seems to have emerged for it is CFIDS, chronic fatigue immune dysfunction. And people call it all different kinds of things. Immune deficiency syndrome sounds awfully close to AIDS. And to some extent, as is the case with all immune kinds of illnesses, there is some overlap. But I think we're dealing with a very different situation here than we are with AIDS. I'm going to develop the argument in a few minutes. So what I think we're really dealing with here is a problem having to do with a new emerging field called psychoneuroimmunology. That there are immunologic, neurologic, endocrine, and psychological components to this syndrome. And the way that it's weighted from client to client varies greatly. That there are some people that may have a stronger psychosocial or psychophysiologic aspects, some may have a stronger immunologic aspect, some may have a stronger neurologic, and so forth. In terms of what it looks like, how are we doing?
Great.
The classic physical symptoms include mild fever, and the fever can be intermittent, it can come and go, sore throat. If you know how to palpate for your lymph nodes, you'll often see some swelling of the lymph nodes. Muscle aches and pains, obviously fatigue, especially after any type of exertion, and prolonged fatigue after exercise. Headaches, joint aches, sleep dysfunction, and then you go through this whole constellation of additional symptoms which vary from person to person. It could include night sweats, it could include gastrointestinal complaints, gastritis, various types, allergies, hyperreactivity to light, noise, odors, sounds, things of that sort. The emotional components are also profound and usually omnipresent too, which includes depression, a real sense of helplessness and malaise. Often there are components of anxiety, irritability, and in a subset of clients, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, there are out and out panic attacks. The cognitive symptoms are again profound. The term that one of my patients came up with, which I think describes it as well as anything I can say, is brain fog. You know? There are cognitive impairments, particularly in short-term memory. There's disorientation. People sometimes forget who they are or where they are. But the short-term memory losses are quite profound. And it's just the sense that there's a fog on my brain. I'm just not thinking as clearly as I was. And there are spiritual consequences in associated symptoms. Because I think just about every patient that I've seen with chronic fatigue syndrome has had some very deep spiritual issues that are associated with this. Why me? Why did this happen to me? Is this some kind of karmic retribution for some terrible thing that I did to somebody? You know, why is this happening to my family and my children and my loved ones and so forth? And these issues, I will tell you, in my opinion, are as important and are as profound as the physical, the cognitive, and the emotional issues. The thing that's most devastating to this population of patients is they don't look sick. And they don't get any sympathy worth a damn. I mean, if they do, they get it for a very short period of time from people, and it gets old really fast. Because they don't limp, they don't hobble, they don't throw up, they don't look green or yellow or purple. I mean, they basically look okay to most health professionals and to the people that are around them. And when they say, well, I'm having a headache, well, everybody gets a headache, you know? What's the big deal? A headache's just, you know, take two aspirin, you know, or Advil or whatever. But the kind of headache they get's a different kind of headache. And if the friends or loved ones had that kind of headache, they'd know that you're dealing with a really different kind of situation. I'm going to tell you my story about how I got involved or interested in this in a little bit, but first I want to introduce you, since there's been some interest in the latest research, to a brand new field in medicine. And I think that chronic fatigue is an archetypal syndrome that will be addressed by this field. And this field is called psychoneuroimmunology. You're going to be hearing a lot more about it if you haven't already. When I went to school, which seems like an awful long time ago, I took different classes at UCLA in immunology, in neurology, in endocrinology, and in psychiatry. And I actually spent a year as a postdoctoral fellow in psychiatry. And in those days, these were considered quite separate and distinct disciplines. And we trained different medical specialists. We have endocrinologists, and we have immunologists, and neurologists, and psychiatrists. And interestingly, they rarely talk to each other. They operate quite independently in a vacuum. What we found over the last 2 or 3 years, maybe I could stretch it and say 4 years, is that these are not four separate systems in the body, but one indivisible system. And that anything that happens in any one of those systems affects all the others. Let's take the most common illustration of this, which is stress. All right? When you get under stress, there are profound immunologic changes. There's an increase in helper-suppressor T-cell ratios, increased macrophage activity. There's a lot of immunologic changes because the body is prepared for some potential threat, some potential danger, right? And if you were to be injured or cut or to bleed or whatever, the body needs to be prepared for that. When you're under stress, there are profound endocrine changes, changes in the adrenals, changes in the thyroid. We pump out adrenal corticosteroids. Changes in the thymus, in many of the endocrine organs in the body that squirt out these various types of hormones which affect the whole organism, which circulate through the blood, affect many different cells in the body. When we're under stress, there are neurologic changes because the body is being mobilized for what Cannon called fight or flight. Okay, we're either going to fight that predator, and win or lose, it'll be over, or we're going to get out of there. All right? And I don't have to tell you about the psychological consequences of stress and how that makes us feel. It's impossible to separate any of that out. There's some chairs up front here if you like, and you're welcome to come on in. So there's this new field called psychoneuroimmunology, and the implications of understanding that we're dealing with one system here are quite profound. Let me give you one little taste of it, okay? If we say that inside the body we have the psychoneuroimmunologic system. Let's look at what happens under four different circumstances. Let's say that we have a provocateur, some provocative agent, some potential threat to the organism that comes from outside the body. A virus, a bacteria, something of that sort. Okay? And if this psychoneuroimmunologic system over-responds to it, all right, what we tend to see is allergy. If this system under-responds to it, we tend to see infection. If the provocative agent is something that's inside the body, like an aberrant cell or something, and the body over-responds to it, we see autoimmune illness, lupus, type 2 diabetes, illness. If it's something that's aberrant or a provocative agent or a potential threat inside the body and the body under-responds to it, we see cancer. Now, in the old days, you'd say, well, what does cancer and allergy and infection and what do these things have in common? It's starting to come together now. We're beginning to see that some things that may look initially to be very disparate have a lot of things in common in terms of the way that the body responds to it. In fact, this field is forcing us to really rethink some of the most basic assumptions that we make about how the body defends itself against various organisms. I think one can now make a good argument that our white blood cells could be considered little floating bits of brain tissue. White blood cells are very intelligent. They have perception, they have memory, they have learning. Right? They have communication. In fact, there's some new studies which show that there are some nerve cells that terminate on white blood cells. We also know, in terms of this developing field of psychoneuroimmunology, that there are lots of tissues in the body that squirt out these very complex peptides that we didn't even know existed a few years ago. For example, if you cut your hand, okay, we used to think, well, you're going to stimulate certain nerve endings here in the hand, which tells the brain that your hand got cut, right? The surprising thing is that even if you cut the nerves that innervate the hand, and you cut the hand, the brain knows that the hand got cut anyway. How does it know? Well, it turns out that some of the cells in the skin itself secrete target peptides, which circulate through the blood, go into the brain, and tell the brain, I came from the hand. There's an injury there. And this whole notion of how the body defends itself against potential stressors, potential threats, various types of microorganisms, is really being completely reformulated now as a result of our understanding of these new informational substances that are carrying on all different kinds of communication in the body all the time. I want to talk I think that there's a couple other things that need to be thrown into this equation, too. One of which are familial factors. I think that there's fairly strong evidence that chronic fatigue syndrome or syndromes like this whole rubric of diagnostic entities which fall under this broad classification of chronic fatigue syndrome. See, I think there's lots of things that can produce chronic fatigue. I think it's like talking about cancer. You know, cancer is not one illness. It's many different kinds of illnesses. Like MS, there's not one MS. There's lots of different variants of it. Same thing with muscular dystrophy and so on. I think that's true of chronic fatigue. There's lots of different types of chronic fatigue. But I think for certain types, there is a clear familial factor that it does tend to run in families. And I think that there are some very strong psychophysiologic factors that have to do with early childhood events, particularly trauma in early childhood, that can set the stage for the body's inability to defend itself against certain type of organisms. But these things sort of go beyond the scope of what we're able to address tonight. Tonight I want to really focus on one aspect of chronic fatigue, because I'm beginning to think it's not only one of the most common aspects, but it's one aspect that we can really do something about. I can really see a difference in the ways that patients are helped when we look at this particular aspect. And this is the aspect that has to do with glucose metabolism, with blood sugar metabolism. And I want to spend a fair amount of time now talking about how chronic candidiasis or systemic yeast infections interact with other factors to produce chronic fatigue, and what we know about it, and more importantly, what we can do about it. And I'll quickly tell you my story, okay? My training was in neurochemistry and neurophysiology at UCLA. I don't know how many of you are familiar with my background, but I was the founder of the pain control unit at UCLA, which kind of was a spinoff of my research there in acupuncture, biofeedback, hypnosis. I was sort of the one at UCLA interested in alternative medicine about 25 years ago. I've been doing acupuncture for 25 years now. And being a neurophysiologist and a neurobiochemist, I wasn't really very open to a lot of these ideas. My training at UCLA was fairly rigorous, and as is the case with many academics, I want to see some double-blind, placebo-controlled, counterbalanced studies before I'm going to buy into it, okay? And I left UCLA in 1980 and went into private practice with 26 other members of the pain control unit. And shortly after we went into practice, I think it was about 1980, 1981, a woman patient had sort of worked her way through all the screening devices and managed to schedule an appointment to come see me without letting anybody in the office know what it was about. And I kind of saw this strange name, just the name of a person, no chart, no medical records, no diagnosis, no nothing. And I thought, gee, that's interesting that somebody could get through all these screening mechanisms and get an appointment to see me without anybody having the faintest idea what she wanted. So I was kind of curious to see what it was about. And woman came in. She was an attractive 45-year-old lady, a little impatient, a little agitated, and I sat down with her, and without even any small talk or chit-chat, she asked me, she said, what do you know about candidiasis? In a real confrontational way. And I thought, I wanted to say to her, not very much, but kind of went back into my memory and remembered the things that I'd studied in pathology and histopathology and so forth, and I said, well, it's commonly seen in young children. We see it as oral candidiasis or thrush. It's a white coating in the mouth, and it's not uncommon in children with not fully formed immune systems. She said, well, who else? So, well, you see it in elderly patients, you know, particularly those who have had diabetes and strokes and multi-system illnesses and so on. She said, well, what about in somebody like my age? So I stretched and I said, I think that there's an incidence of it in patients who are undergoing immunosuppressive therapy for organ transplants or cancer, you know, cancer chemotherapy. And she kept shaking her head. She said, well, what about somebody like me who doesn't have any of that, just an otherwise healthy person? What do you know about candidiasis in this population? And I said, well, as far as I know, it's virtually unheard of in otherwise healthy people. And at this point, she got very agitated, very angry, and just kind of tore me up one side down the other and basically said, you doctors don't know anything. You don't read the literature. All you care about is taking our money and giving us drugs and this and that. And she just tore me up one way and down the other. I'm not used to having patients talk that way to me. Most of them are pretty grateful for the care that I provide, and I'm generally pretty successful in providing them with pain relief. And it really affected me. And that night, after just being beaten up by this lady, I stopped back at UCLA. I went into the biomedical library and just did a literature search on candidiasis to see what I could find, and found that there was a research team at the University of Kentucky headed by a man by the name of Orion Truss, who was doing some work. So the next day I called him and talked to him for a while, and he sounded like, you know, academics, we're kind of stuffy people, and we want to make sure that other researchers are publishing in peer-reviewed journals and all that kind of stuff. And he had published several papers and sounded like he knew what he was talking about, but he seemed a little off the wall to me, because he was saying, this thing is epidemic, you know, if you know what to look for, you're going to start to see it and so many of your patients and this and that. And I don't know, I always react a little funny when people hard sell me anything. But nevertheless, I asked him to send me his papers, and which he did, and I started looking at his papers that he had published about it, and I began to think, gee, you know, I've got quite a few patients that had this constellation of symptoms. And what he did, he ultimately wrote a book called The Missing Diagnosis. And in this book, he described 50 to 100 symptoms that are so common and are seen in so many situations, fatigue and malaise and headaches and joint aches and irritability and upset stomach. I mean, it could be anything. It wasn't that clear. But for one reason or another, it seemed to attract my interest. And I began to realize that I had a couple of patients that had been referred in with headaches that had been intractable to all other kinds of treatment, had not been responding well to medications that their physicians had prescribed, were not even responding well to acupuncture and biofeedback and some of the alternative things that we were looking at. And I said, what the hell? Let's work them up for candidiasis. And I was astounded when I started asking them these questions to find how many of them they would say yes to. Strange questions like, are you really sensitive to odors and smells like perfumes and colognes? Right? Do you have skin rashes? Or does your hair dry, feel dry and brittle? Does your fingernails feel brittle? You know, things that normally you wouldn't think to ask in doing this type of evaluation. So I had a small group of about half a dozen patients that I felt seemed very positive. So I called up Truss and found out how he was treating patients in those days. In those days, we were using a drug called nystatin. Now, nystatin is a very benign drug. It's probably one of the safest drugs in the PDR, in the physician's desk reference. We give it to six-month-old babies for up to a year with no untoward effects. I mean, couldn't ask for a much safer drug. So we started giving these patients nystatin, and immediately they did horribly. Many of them went to bed and didn't get out for 3 weeks. I mean, I've never seen patients react to nystatin like that. It wasn't until much later that we realized that nystatin, for whatever reason, is delivered in a liquid suspension, which is 50% sucrose. So you're killing the parasite and feeding it at the same time. Anyway, so we started to up it to what to what Trust was using, which were two other drugs, Nizoral and Ketoconazole, which are very powerful antifungals. And if any of you are taking any of these medications, you want to make sure that your doctor is taking blood from you every week. Not every month, as they generally recommend, but every week. Because people that have chronic fatigue with complications related to candidiasis, their liver is already very well challenged by this. And when you start to give hepatotoxic drugs like ketoconazole or Nizoral, I mean, these drugs really have very strong effects on the liver. You want to make sure that your doctor is monitoring you very closely on those drugs. Anyway, these patients did horribly, and we kept calling Trust, and he said, I had the same experience, you got to stay with it, and we told him to ride it out, and after a couple of months of active nystatin therapy, many of them started to feel better, and they started to feel profoundly better, that they hadn't, and again, it was very anecdotal. And we started to get excited because their headaches, these were intractable headaches that have been resistant to all forms of treatment. Their headaches were being reduced in severity, intensity, and duration, frequency, and so on. And we got very interested at this time. And shortly thereafter, a man by the name of William Crook, who had also sort of followed a similar path, published a book called The Yeast Connection, which probably many of you are familiar with. And we got in touch with Crook right away. And he was the one that turned us on to the fact that you can't give nystatin in suspension, you give it in a powder. And we wrote the pharmaceutical company. And what we found was, how we would distribute nystatin? By the toothpick. We would have patients wet a toothpick, a quarter of an inch, a half an inch, or 1 inch, all the way up, dip it in the nystatin powder, and put that in their mouth. And that was about all they could tolerate. And again, we had the same thing. Patients were really having a rough time on this particular regime. But if we stayed with it long enough and just tried to treat them symptomatically through it over a period of time, they did start to respond and do quite a bit better. I don't use nystatin or Nizoral or ketoconazole or anything else, any other medications at all at this point, because the difficulty that we saw and other people see is that there's a very high incidence of recidivism. Within 6 months, these patients are back in with candidiasis and chronic fatigue syndrome again, and you wonder, was it really worth it? And I will tell you shortly about what we are now using, which we are seeing looks about as close as we can get to a permanent cure for candidiasis, and that excites us a lot. Okay, how do people develop candidiasis, and what is it about? Now, I'm going to tell you, in a very unscientific, anecdotal way, just one doctor's personal opinion, and don't hold me to this, because as I say, this is something that we don't know a lot about. But I'll just give you my thoughts about how this happens. See, normally, when the immune system is robust, and we get exposed to yeast and other parasites, the immune system creates an environment that's hostile for it to colonize, except in certain locations. It's not unusual for women to develop a manilia or a vaginal yeast infection because it's a nice, warm, moist area, which is where yeast likes to grow, right? And it has access to the blood supply, so it gets sugar to feed itself in that way. What we're talking about is something quite different. We're talking about systemic candida, candida that gets into the system, typically in the GI tract. Although I have very strong suspicions that many people with chronic bronchitis and that have this productive cough probably have candida in the bronchi. A lot of patients that were diagnosed with asthma and emphysema probably have candidiasis. It can probably be anywhere in the body, wherever it colonizes. But so far, it looks like the most common place is somewhere in the GI tract, either, I'd say the two most common areas are in the colon itself is over here in the splenic flexure. You have the ascending colon comes up the right side, the transverse colon comes across, and then it makes a 180-degree turn right over here under the left breast. And in that tight area where it turns around, that's a favorite place for candida to colonize. And these patients come in with complaints of chest pain, and they've had the Blue Cross special $1 million workup, every cardiovascular test and gallbladder studies and lung scans, and nobody can find anything.
They always call it an irritable bowel syndrome too.
I'm going to talk about that in a minute, because that's the other place, which is right at the juncture of the bowel and the rectum, and it's kind of a low, deep aching place. But as I say, it can colonize anywhere. One of the most common etiologic sources, I mean, where it arises from, is the promiscuous use of drugs, particularly antibiotics, and especially broad-spectrum antibiotics. 20 years ago, before we had broad-spectrum antibiotics, doctors used to do a test called a CNS, a culture insensitivity. And let's say you had a sore throat. They take a swab, okay, of whatever the organism was, and they grow it on an agar plate that had different kind of antibiotics, penicillin, different types of penicillin, and so on. And they would watch and see which antibiotic caused that organism to stop growing. And yet, which was the gentlest, safest antibiotic. Now they've developed these broad-spectrum antibiotics, these nuclear weapons, okay, that just kill off everything, like Keflex, right,
yeah.
And tetracycline, right? You know, these incredibly powerful antibiotics. So it's not necessary to do a CNS, because you kill everything. The difficulty is that it not only kills off the bad organisms, it kills off the good ones, the friendlies. And I want to talk to you a minute about the friendly organisms that live in your gut. Because again, this is very new research, and probably 99 out of 100 physicians aren't even familiar with this work. When I went to school, as I recall, I was basically taught that the colon was this sort of passive tube between the small intestine, which absorbs the nutrients out of your food, and the rectum. All right? Then Hans Selye came along in the 50s and did his pioneering work on stress, and we began to realize that the colon's very much involved in water regulation. When you go in under stress, your basal metabolic rate goes up, the activity of all the cells increases, and you urinate a lot, because water is the fluid that carries the waste products out of cells. All right? If you don't consequently increase your intake of fluids, where's the water come from? It's absorbed out of the colon. The colon's like a sponge, and that's the most common cause of constipation. People that are under stress and aren't drinking adequate amounts of fluid, the colon absorbs the fluids it needs and leaves them constipated. So the best cure for most types of constipation is stress management and fluids. Okay, and you don't have to take a lot of laxatives and all kinds of other things. Anyway, recently, over the last couple years, there's increasing evidence that these organisms that live there, these friendly microorganisms, particularly Lactobacillus acidophilus, which tends to colonize in the small intestine, and Lactobacillus bifidus, which colonizes in the large intestine, work symbiotically with cells, with mucosal cells in that area, to produce some very interesting substances. The one that's most common, has been most thoroughly studied so far, is a substance called VIP, which is vasoactive intestinal peptide. And it's another one of these very complex informational substances. When you ask, where's VIP found in the body? What's so astounding is it's found in highest concentrations in the brain, next in the liver, in the spleen and pancreas, in the kidneys, in the lungs. All right? So you say, what's going on here? Why would a substance be manufactured in the colon be found in highest concentration in the brain? Now realize this is a vasoactive peptide. What does that mean? It means it controls blood flow. All right, that's what it does. And we don't know a lot about VIP, except one could make a very good argument that when you take broad-spectrum antibiotics, and you're not replacing these friendly organisms like bifida and acidophilus and some others, the body loses its ability to make VIP, and that there are going to be central nervous system effects from it, and effects in the spleen and liver, which affects digestion and so many other processes in the body. And it turns out that the colon is much more important for our good health than any of us, except a few radical health food fanatics, ever thought. I was trained in East Coast schools. I did my training in Boston. When I came out to California in the mid-60s, I thought people out here were nuts. I thought they were absolutely crazy. They would say things like, don't ever charcoal broil food. It produces cancer, and you know, and eat lots of roughage. They seem to be preoccupied with their colon, you know, and keep the colon clean, and eat lots of high-fiber foods and raw vegetables, and watch out for the water. The water's hazardous to your health, and you know, drink only bottled water. And you'd think, these people are just paranoid. They're crazed, all right? And yet, over the years, we found that just about every concern that those people had are being scientifically documented, Okay, and now we find it's also true in terms of maintaining proper health of the colon, of the large intestine, that it is more than just a tube to carry waste products. It is more than just a part of the body that has to do with water retention. There's a lot of very important things that are manufactured there. And as I said, this is, work is so new, we don't have any idea yet, really, what many of these things do. Okay, so when you take antibiotics, and particularly these broad-spectrum antibiotics and other drugs like gantrecin or Flagyl, okay, again, very powerful drugs, they can affect the normal microorganisms that live there, which die off. And once they die off, it allows for opportunistic infection by Candida. Because normally, Bifida and Acidophilus compete with the Candida and keep candidiasis very well controlled. There may be some Candida in the stool, but typically it's acute in transit. I mean, it just passes right through. It doesn't form a colony and live there. But as a result of stress, as a result of trauma, as a result of some of these drugs, there can be other factors. If a colony of Candida starts to form, like many microorganisms, it lives to do two things. Number one, to eat, and number two, to reproduce. And let's talk about that for a minute. What does Candida eat? What does sugar eat? What does a yeast eat? Sugar, right? That's what it eats, right? So what happens? You have living in your gut a microorganism that's competing with every other organ of your body for glucose. See, no matter what nutrients you eat, for it to be utilized for energy in the body, it's ultimately going to be reduced to glucose. So now you have a little organism living in your gut that's now competing with all the other organisms, all the other organs in the body, for available glucose. And it produces a clinical syndrome that's very much like hypoglycemia. Except there's a catch. If you do a glucose tolerance test, which is thought to be the definitive test for hypoglycemia, it's normal. That is, unless you take it out 7 or 8 hours. How many of you have ever had a glucose tolerance test? This is not a fun experience. Okay, I've had them. This is not a fun experience. I don't know about you, but try to be fasted, okay, and drink a big bottle of Karo syrup, all right, and then wait around for 4 hours and watch how you feel. I don't know about anybody else, but I was climbing the walls after about 3 hours. And we're not sadists, you know, we're not going to run an 8-hour glucose tolerance test on a patient. I mean, they'd need psychiatric hospitalization after that, if not medical hospitalization. But if you do run it out that long, there's some evidence that there are some abnormalities in later stage in the glucose tolerance test for Candida. Anyway, it eats glucose, so it does give you all those kinds of symptoms of hypoglycemia, fatigue and malaise, you know. Think about the brain for a minute. It's really interesting. The brain, let's say your brain weighs about 3 or 4 pounds, all right? So by weight, maybe it represents 2 or 3% of your body, but it uses 25% of the glucose in your body. It's this huge metabolic organ. All right, it uses huge amounts of oxygen and glucose. And so when you have a parasite that's consuming glucose, your brain's going to start to feel deprived of it. And it's not unreasonable to see that it could produce short-term memory impairment, brain fog, disorientation, fatigue, and so forth. And think about the effects on the liver and the kidneys and the other organs. Okay, so you have this parasite that's stealing, literally stealing your available energy. That's what glucose is. It's a source of energy. Now, what does it give you in return? It gives you two things. Number one is gas, right? That's what product of yeast fermentation, right? And it also secretes aldehydes, particularly acid aldehyde. Do you all know, remember what formaldehyde is? Do you ever dissect frogs in high school and so forth? You know what formaldehyde is? A preservative, this really nasty, caustic stuff. Well, that's what Candida secretes, acid aldehydes. It's a very, very toxic substance. Let me put it to you this way. Suppose I had a nice big jar of formaldehyde and I could do this non-traumatically. And I said, okay, I'm going to swab the inside of your intestines with some formaldehyde. How do you think that's going to feel? It's not going to make your day. I can promise you that. Now, where does this stuff go? It's now appearing that most of the aldehydes that are produced as a result of Candida metabolism are excreted through the perspiration. And that's, again, why you see people with chronic candidiasis. Women tend to report this more than men because they pay more attention to it, I think. But that's why their hair is brittle and dry. And they're always reporting dry skin. If you ever worked with formaldehyde or acetaldehyde, you know what a drying effect it has on the body. I mean, I don't know if you remember what it was like. But that's why the nails can be brittle, the hair can be brittle and dry, the skin can be dry. People report skin sloughing off under their fingernails and so forth. Sometimes rashes, particularly in flexor creases, you know, under the arms and in the groin and so forth. And it's not unusual to see skin irritation as one of the physical symptoms of candidiasis.
Is there anything unusual about perspiration itself? Or
in some people it can be. It can have a peculiar type of odor associated with it. Some people get a metallic kind of taste in their mouth. The symptoms vary widely, but not everybody, some people excrete it more in the lungs than in the perspiration. It really varies, and as I say, we're really in the dark. There's so much more that we don't know than we do know. One thing I feel very confident is in about 5 or 10 years, you won't find too many doctors not addressing these very issues that I'm talking about today. This stuff is for real, and it's epidemic. Crook, last time I talked to him, he's now estimating 1 in 3 women and 1 in 10 men have candidiasis. That's epidemic. So basically, what you've got in living in the gut is this organism which is going to produce irritable bowel syndrome because it's producing these toxic substances as a result of its metabolism. Skin problems. Another very common thing that I see associated with candidiasis is tinea versicolor. This is a fungus that grows on the skin that is impervious to ultraviolet light. And so when you go out in the sun and get a tan, you see these white patches that won't tan. All right? Just these white patchy areas because the ultraviolet can't get through them. And that's very commonly seen. It's tinea, T-I-N-E-A, versicolor. It's a fungus, kind of a cousin of athlete's foot. Dandruff, you know, the same tinea.
You only see that with a candidiasis?
No, you can see it in other people too. So think about it for a minute, okay? You've got this symbiotic organism that won't kill you, but it'll sometimes make you wish you were dead. Stealing your glucose and giving you as a byproduct of its metabolism poison. And people with candidiasis quite routinely feel toxic. They tell you that. And they may not be able to articulate it, but they say, something's wrong. I just feel like something's wrong. I don't know what it is. If you were to consume formaldehyde, you'd feel toxic too. All right? So a lot of this stuff is starting to make sense. Let me talk about panic attacks. Panic attacks occur probably maybe in under 5%, 5 to 10% of the population of those who have candida. And the type of panic attacks they have is very reminiscent of a diabetic just before they go into ketoacidosis. Okay, in other words, your blood sugar can operate within a certain range, right? And when it moves out of that range, fairly catastrophic kinds of things can happen. A panic attack that's characterized by very low blood sugar levels is a very unpleasant thing. If any of you have ever been through it, I can promise you, you'd never want to go through it again, and you know that. But it's the sense of completely losing control, a desperate need for somebody, anybody, to be there with you, feeling right on the verge of about to lose consciousness. Does anybody here experience this kind of thing? Could describe it better than I do?
I know my grandmother did.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Very jittery, very nervous, and very frightened. And the thing that's interesting about this is if any of you are having these problems, you should carry some sugar with you. While I do not recommend sugar as a nutrient, I do recommend it as a drug. And when the blood sugar drops that low, you can abort these panic attacks literally in 10 seconds just by putting some sugar in your mouth and letting it absorb sublingually into the circulation. I mean, you'll stop a panic attack like that.
Can I ask you, this panic attack, it gets called that because of the person's response, psychological response to the physiological symptoms?
Yes. It is psychologically perceived as panic on the part of the patient. And they start to freak. They just feel like they're losing it completely and don't know what to do.
I got a question.
Sure.
These organisms that live in like this, where do they originate from? Like, does a newborn baby have it, or is this transmitted from person to person? I'm not sure. Is this hanging out there ready to live right there?
And yeah, yeast is everywhere.
If we were to live in a very sterile atmosphere, like a bubble, with completely filtered like that, would we have the problem?
It's unclear. The exact epidemiology of how people are affected by Candida albicans, which is this particular strain that's found in candidiasis, is really unclear at this point. We know that yeast is basically everywhere and in everything. You walk by a bakery, there's spores of yeast flying through the air. Anyway, you just inhale baked bread and you're going to probably pick up some. Yeah. You'll probably pick it up from spores. I mean, yeast is found in a lot of dietary nutritional supplements, vitamins. A lot of B vitamins are yeast-based. It's found in beverages, beer and wine in particular. Certainly in most baked goods, there's baker's yeast. Baker's yeast and brewer's yeast are different from Candida, but it's not clear how this, how we actually get exposed to it.
Good and the bad.
You know, I'm going to say one thing about the viral etiology of chronic fatigue syndrome, and just say this in passing, but a lot of people have chronic fatigue syndrome titer positively for Epstein-Barr virus. But that's really not impressive, because probably 85% of the population titers positive for EBV. But not 85% of the population has chronic fatigue. Epstein-Barr virus is very common, for a lot of people to have, and most people have it relatively asymptomatically, or they have it as part of childhood, as typical childhood illnesses that we get. Cytomegalovirus is seen in this population. Coxsackie B virus is seen. Some herpes viruses are seen. There is probably a viral etiology, meaning a certain subset of people with chronic fatigue syndrome. Their immune system, their endocrine system, their nervous system was weakened by a virus attack that they didn't fully recover from. Right? I'm not saying that all chronic fatigue is candidiasis. The difficulty is that there's not a whole hell of a lot that we can do for most viruses. I mean, we can't cure the common cold. I happen to be one of those who feels that we probably will never, not in my lifetime, come up with a drug that's effective in treating viruses. And I think that the money that we're spending in looking for the cure for AIDS in a drug is probably not well spent, particularly when there's a very rich literature that we get rid of viruses a very different kind of way. And the way we can get rid of viruses effectively is by exposing ourselves to other viruses, as we do in, with the Salk vaccine, which is live poliovirus, as we do with smallpox, which is cowpox. And there are ways, let's say the immune system has a wisdom much greater than the neuropharmacologists have been able to come up with. So I'm not saying that there is not a viral etiology to chronic fatigue. There's probably a subset that has a very strong viral etiology, but we have not yet discovered therapeutic interventions that can do much about it. Within that subset, there are probably a large portion of people that also have candidiasis. And what's interesting is when you treat the candida, the residuals are so minimal that they're able to handle it well. And maybe this is, I'm kind of going out of order, but maybe this is a good opportunity to bring up an important concept, which is in working with patients with chronic fatigue, it's important to address two aspects of their illness. All right? One is the fatigue itself, and obviously to do as much as we possibly can to treat the etiologic factor, what's causing the fatigue and the symptoms of it. But the second part is their tolerance to their illness. Any of you who are dealing with chronic fatigue or any other illness know that there are times when you are just exhausted, but you're really enjoying what you're doing, you're with people that you like, or you're watching something interesting on TV or whatever, and you're handling it. You're fatigued, but you're tolerating it. You're handling it well. And there are other times when you may not even be that tired, or your brain may not even be that foggy, but it's got you. You have no tolerance for it at all. You've lost it, all right? And what I'm saying is, even with the viral etiologies, while there may not be a whole lot that we can do to treat the fatigue itself, there's an incredible amount that we can do to help people raise their tolerance to the fatigue to the point where it's not even bothering them. When they've embraced a different kind of lifestyle, when they've done some things to treat some of the symptoms and so forth, and they realize there are going to be some limitations in terms of what I can do. But there's an awful lot of things I can do, and this is how I do it. And I'm going to get to that when I start getting into treatment modalities. But I don't want people to think that by any means that I'm saying that all chronic fatigue is candidiasis. If you want a rough guess, I'll stick my neck out and say half of it is. That's how prevalent I think it is. And I think even those with viral etiologies, probably half of them have candidiasis as a contributing factor. Question?
Do you do a candida antibody test to get a new diagnosis?
That's a good question. Do we do antibody test? I don't anymore. And the reason is that these tests are unreliable and also very expensive. And I've not found them good predictors of therapy. If you want to know what I find to be probably the best diagnostic test for candidiasis, it's a careful history. In Bill Crook's book called The Yeast Connection, there's a 3-page self-administered questionnaire. And I find that probably correlates with my clinical findings as well as any instrument that I've found. That book's in most libraries and Crown Books, you can get it. And if you score more than 100 points on that questionnaire, I think there's a fairly good likelihood that you have candida. And what I find is that most patients that I think are diagnosable by history, they score like 250 or 350. They're up there. And it's